The following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Okay, good morning, everybody. Welcome. And welcome to our friends here this morning, our new friends, and our regular friends. It's comforting to have the support. So, today's Mother's Day, and I consider it a great honor to be able to offer my deepest respect and gratitude to mothers everywhere, past and present. There's no one who doesn't have a mother. And whatever issues we may still have that are unresolved with mom, I think we can agree that our mothers gave us the precious opportunity of life. They nurtured and raised us. And a mother has to put her own needs ahead of another for extended periods of time. You know, beginning with her giving the nutrients of her own body to the developing fetus, then going through oftentimes morning sickness, depression, fatigue during the pregnancy, and then the agony of childbirth. And essentially, the mom is a slave to her infant for quite a long time, having to nurse the child at night, being waking up and being sleep deprived during the day. So clearly all of this is in the terrain of the Bodhisattva. The figure of Avalokiteshvara responding to the meats in front of her, using her body as the eyes and arms, responding to, well, with the child, the needs are incessant. And as Winnicott famously said, there's no such thing as a baby without a mother. They form symbiotic union. One can't exist. The baby can't exist without the mother. And we might add that without a supportive environment, we don't have a mother. So I saw a TikTok, or maybe it was a YouTube video, I can't remember, recently, of a young mother singing to her baby. Beautiful voice. It might even have been a hymn, actually, something to do with the words of, you know, you're perfect. And to see the baby was about 6 or 7 months old, completely wrapped by the mother's voice and holding her gaze. And then the tears began to fall. As it held mother's gaze and listened to her voice and was receiving with all of its little being this transmission, that who you are is perfect beyond compare, and precious beyond compare. And it was as if the little body was almost too much for that to be contained. And I thought of, you know, the Buddha's, the legend has it, he said his first words were, "I alone am the world ongoing. I am that." So we're fortunate when we've had that moment with the mothers. And this is what drives us to the cushion then as adults, isn't it? Spend years and years. Recovering or remembering this truth that we, through the pains, intentions, and agonies of life, we forget. So we've only, I think, in the past, 20, 30 years, begun to understand to what extent a child's sense of self is influenced by how the mother sees and treats the child. For whatever she fails to recognize in her child is likely to fail to recognize in him or herself. So mom is important. And we might say likewise that whatever society fails to recognize in a woman, she may fail to recognize in herself. And so what I'd like to do in the next few moments in my talk is to lift up the contributions of women to our Buddhist practice. And I'm going back to when certainly women didn't have recognition, much less support. And we know that because the references to women in the Buddhist literature are pretty scarce. But often when a woman appears, they show the capacity to subtly influence events. You'll remember when the young woman Sujata, for example, brings an emaciated Buddha a bowl of rice and milk. You know, he's been fasting, he's been going through these rigorous ascetic practices that leaves his body exhausted and emaciated. And when she presents the bowl of rice, his companions flee at the sight of the Buddha having anything to do with a woman. And he receives the bowl of rice, eats it, and nourished by it, his strength returns. And he resolves then that in the future he will pursue a middle way. A way that no longer denies the body. So this theme of denying or mortifying the body is a way to transcend the exigencies of physical existence, you know, be it sexual urges or the desire for pleasure or comfort. This theme has played out in most world religions. In early Buddhism, it involved the aspiration to leave the cycle of existence altogether, to attain nirvana, so that one wouldn't have to take on a human body ever again. So we see this tension between the aspiration for liberation or freedom from suffering, while inhabiting a body that is vulnerable to pain and craves comfort. But this is a difficult balancing act, this tension, the aspiration for freedom in bodily form. And we see that throughout or up until, you know, through history, at least the last maybe 2,000 years, women have been conflated with this gravitational pull towards the earth or the physical realm, while men might locate their spiritual urge as being freed from their ties to matter or mother. So we see in the idea of home leaving, going forth into homelessness as a path of liberation, that this is a natural extension of the need to break one's attachment to comfort, to the material world, as a way of training the ox, curbing one's desire nature. So after his enlightenment, Shakyamuni came back home to preach to the Shakya clan and to invite the men to join his band of home leavers. And so many joined that there were many widows left behind. Now we have to understand that the Buddha was the Buddha's time was, you know, it's called the Axial Age, which was a time when, like our own, there was a lot of social dislocation happening. Massive inequality, wealth, huge fortunes, you know, kings, monarchs, with their aristocrats, their nobles, amazing wealth, and then the poor. But you also had, with the rise of trade and commerce, a rising class with towns growing and ideas circulating. And with this rising class, then you have people who are more curious about, it's kind of like a sort of, you could say, a shift in consciousness. Rather than the absolute authority of the king or the priests who would perform the ceremonies that would protect people, there was more of a wherewithal for people to begin to want to look to themselves as a way to discover the nature of reality. So the Buddha's teachings were right in line with this new consciousness that was developing. And so the men, yes, the men donned the robes and they followed the Buddha. And even later, when his father died, King Suddhodana, these numbers increased. And so it said that the men followed the Buddha in torrents, because even though he had renounced his princedom, they still considered him their leader. But the thing is that it left the women behind, you know, without husbands, sons, fathers. Families were torn apart. Nothing is mentioned about the children. I guess children didn't exist until recently. So Mahaprajapati, who had nursed the Buddha after the death of his own mother, she was the first to request permission to follow along. And the Buddha refused. And he refused three times. But I guess her whatever it was that motivated her, she with a band of, they say, 500 other women, shaved their heads, donned the saffron robes, and on foot walked to Vaisali, which is about 150 miles away. It took them 4 months, these noble women, to again say, you know, we want to do this. We want to leave too. We want to pursue the mendicant path. We want to follow the teachings and have a practice just like the men. And Buddha said, gee, gee whiz, I'd really rather that you stay and be a lay practitioner. I'd rather the women didn't go into homelessness, only the men. So it took Ananda, apparently, to persuade the Buddha to allow the women to form a monastic order, an order of nuns, which he did. And with the on condition that they would follow eight rules, which really put them in a very subordinate position to the monks. So we might say, well, you know, what a time of disruption and dislocation. And I find it actually comforting because it's the parallels with our own time, the sense of paradigm shift that involves a lot of pain, a lot of suffering. But in this case, we see in the service of a different order, if you will, of an organization, different social organizing. So now we have large numbers of people who are devoted to looking at their own minds and looking into their own selves as a way to resolve this issue of suffering. For myself, growing up in Ireland in the 60s with the nuns, you know, even though I found their form of spirituality kind of cramped, I had a real respect and gratitude for just their existence at a time when in Ireland, basically the only model one had was for a woman was one of a mother and wife. And I already knew as a teenager and younger that this is not going to be me. And so I was grateful for just this model of another path. I still remember Mother Bernadine we had for just one semester. She taught us, I think it was Macbeth, before she was posted to one of the other swankier boarding schools. And her departure, it broke my heart. But not before giving me a glimpse of the exciting potential of cultivating the mind. So I still give gratitude to nuns for their path. Now, another woman that stands out for me at the time of the Buddha and whose name, you know, I didn't know is a lay practitioner by the name of Visheka. She was wealthy, a devout practitioner, but also a counselor to the Buddha, you know, in the disputes among the monks. And she made important contributions, apparently, both in terms of her close observations of the community and what they needed, as well as her own material generosity in meeting those needs. So in one encounter, she comes to the Buddha and she says, I have 8 requests. And he listens. And I think the requests are interesting because they kind of give us a glimpse, you know, into some of the difficulties of organizing communities in the early stages. So a lot of her requests had to do with the problems posed by the rule that the monks had of eating before noon. They had to have their last meal before noon. That was, and as we know, the meal was gleaned by begging. So they had to go into town and beg. And accept whatever was put in their bowl. So this woman, Visheka, comes to the Buddha and she points out some of the problems that this rule creates. There are monks, for instance, who come traveling, visiting from out of town. Well, they don't know where to go and beg. And so they end up hungry. Or she said, monks who need to go traveling outside, they're not able to meet their caravans on time because, you know, they may not be able to get enough food before leaving. Or she said she noticed monks who are sick and they often have to make do with unwholesome food or no food at all. Or those who take care of the sick monks, she said, they often don't have time to go and beg. And then she said, furthermore, she felt that the monks were not able, they weren't eating good enough food. And she suggested maybe that at least they could have some rice gruel as a staple. She also noticed that in the rainy season, the monks, because they only had one set of robes, in order to keep their robes dry, what did they do? They stripped naked and wandered around naked. And she didn't think that was appropriate. And then the nuns, they washed in the river, but they had to bathe naked too, because they didn't have bathing garments. So the Buddha listens to all of this, and I'm thinking, how come it took this laywoman to notice this? Did nobody else not see what was going on? And so the Buddha, you know, he grants her request, and then he asks an interesting question. He asks her to account for the benefit of this gift that she's going, the benefit to herself. How is she going to benefit from these donations? And here's the response she gives. She said, well, when I remember my gifts, I'll be glad. And when I'm glad, I'll be happy. And when my mind is happy, my body will be tranquil. And when my body is tranquil, I will feel pleasure. And when I feel pleasure, my mind will become concentrated. That will maintain the spiritual factors in being in me. Spiritual factors in being in me. And also the spiritual powers and also the enlightenment factors. So when I see this line, when I feel pleasure, my mind will become concentrated, and I think of the baby. And how fully attentive the infant is when it experiences the pleasure of the love that it sees through its mother's eyes. His whole being awash in sensations of delight, enraptured by being itself. That's our nature. That's our nature when we are fully able to be in our bodies and relax into the body and know that we're safe and held. But back to Visheka, I think, you know, here's Visheka sort of gently reminding the Buddha that spiritual life isn't enhanced by starvation, honorable one, nor neglect. And that taking care of one's basic needs is important. Because only when we have our own basic needs met can we then tend to the needs of others and consider the needs of others. And of course, she goes on further to say that feeling good isn't a hindrance to calming the mind, but that actually, it confirms what neurobiology now tells us, that when we're in our optimal zone, which is why we meditate, we naturally feel a connection to everything. And we naturally go into a meditative state, maybe just to add that in the 40 or so years that I've been around Zen communities now, um, it's very clear they wouldn't survive without the inevitable lay female practitioner who shows up, who's perceptive, pragmatic, generous with her resources, be they material, time, emotional. She may provide organizational skills. She may help with sewing raquasus, retreat registration, devising programs, running a newsletter, administrative tasks, taking care of the flowers, or our social media feed, or providing the architectural know-how for the Musendo. That our practice wouldn't be possible without the usual invisible nurturing that happens behind the scenes, that laying on of hands to tend and take care. So my immense gratitude for that figure comes in many shapes and forms. And I have a thought too about how our men folk, just to show that there is an evolution in consciousness, that who managed to hold families and households and jobs, and who don't simply leave home or don't simply sign up for a retreat or absent themselves for a weekend without first consulting with their spouses. We see this over and over again. That awareness that our practice is not in isolation, that it affects all of the other, it affects the whole social matrix in which we find ourselves. And that to me is a very, very hopeful development in evolution, because it's not, it's bringing together this tension that we have for millennia fought, this tension that says the spirit, true nature is somewhere out there in some remote place. When you fasted enough or sat long enough, but that we're bringing it home. That we're bringing our time on the cushion back into our lives, into our ordinary moment-to-moment existence. In recognition that we are always receiving and transmitting. That which sustains us. So I've heard some people refer to the times that we're living in as that we are in the birth canal. Just like the Buddhist time, in transition to a higher understanding, but that we have the pain of childbirth to go through. And so we take our courage and inspiration from the fact that mothers have shown us that this is survivable. This is doable. And so once again, we offer our gratitude. And I think of my own mother, Lily, as I say this, who gave birth to 7 children. And kept her sanity most of the time.